This is a test, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Norman, I want to tell you about an incident that happened in 1956 when I went home to Huron, South Dakota to give my regular campaign speech during the election years. I always made a trip back to the hometown of Huron. It was expected that I would do so. And the local Democrats would put on a big show at the town auditorium. They'd pack in anywhere from 4 to 5,000 people, Republicans and Democrats alike. They came primarily just to hear one of their local boys that they thought had made good. And many times the audience would be filled with people who didn't agree with my political point at all. But Democrats and Republicans alike would come to listen to my message. In 1956, I proceeded give a real sharp attack upon the Eisenhower administration. I pointed out that Dwight Eisenhower, the Republican, who always was talking about balanced budgets and frugality in government, etc., now had a deficit of over $13 billion. And I made quite a point of it, that here was the Republicans and Eisenhower himself condoning this kind of a massive federal deficit. After the meeting was over, Mother always used to have a party after these meetings out to the house. She'd invite in her neighbors and some of Dad's old friends and, of course, many of her friends. And this would sort of be a social hour following the political meeting. Now, you have to understand that people would come to that political meeting at the auditorium just because it was Hubert Humphrey, local boy, that was there speaking. I'd been mayor of Minneapolis, and now I was United States Senator. And my father had been active in politics, and so it was just sort of a get-together with the people of many persuasions willing to come and listen. And I would give them one of my best rip-roaring political speeches. And in this particular occasion, I was really putting the wood to the Republicans and giving working President Eisenhower over pretty heavily. When I came home to Mother's house after the meeting, I walked in and said hello to the guests that were there, and Mother called me out into the kitchen. I could see that she was very upset, and she took me aside and she said, "Hubert, I don't quite know what to say to you." She said, "You know, there are many of my friends out here, and she said, "I'm very embarrassed. I've invited in my personal friends and friends of your father, and just as I've done on every time that you've been home for these political meetings. But tonight I have to tell you I was ashamed of you. Your father would have never said the things that you did. As much of a Democrat as he was, and as much as a partisan as he was, he never would have spoken about President Eisenhower like you did." And I said, "Well, Mother, what did I say that was so bad? Don't be so upset with me." She said, "Well, you just plain lied about him." And she said, "I don't like that." And she said, "You've embarrassed me. And I just can't stand it," and so on. So Mother just carried on. And I said, "Mom, why do you say I lied?" She said, "Well, you got up there and told all those people tonight that President Eisenhower had a deficit in the budget of over $13 billion. She says, "Now, Hubert, you know that's not true." She says, "Republicans don't have deficits. And particularly Mr. Eisenhower wouldn't have it." Mother always thought the world of President Eisenhower, and she just didn't believe that he could possibly have a fiscal situation where the government was in such a miserable position as a $13 billion deficit. Of course, one of the most serious situations that faced the Kennedy administration was known as the Cuban Missile Crisis. I was out in Minnesota at the time that the photographs, that the aerial reconnaissance photographs were taken of the missiles in Cuba. I received a telephone call from the White House from Kenny O'Donnell, saying that the president was calling in the congressional leadership. to discuss this critical situation. At that time, I was the majority whip of the Senate. I was told that an airplane would come by and would pick me up, which of course happened. They had stopped by, that plane also stopped by to pick up Senator Burke Hickenlooper of Iowa. He was the ranking Republican at that, one of the ranking Republicans on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and also a member of the Republican leadership in the Senate. We flew directly to Washington, and the President Kennedy met with the leaders of the House and the Senate in the Cabinet Room. Present were the Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, the Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The Secretary of the Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, with members of the CIA staff, displayed for us displayed before us the aerial photographs taken of the missile sites in Cuba. There was there was demonstrable evidence that missiles were being placed on location. Then subsequently, there were pictures shown to us of Soviet ships bringing in missiles. The pictures were so accurate as to show the body of the missile lying on deck, of course, properly covered. The President told us of that, and described to us the seriousness of the situation, and said that this could not be tolerated. We were kept informed all during that critical week as to developments in Cuba. I recall President Kennedy's message to the nation, and alerting the American people to the gravity of the situation. In fact, in Washington, there is every reason to believe that it might very well deteriorate to a position of actual conflict. Of course, everyone was hoping and praying that that would not be the case. Following one of the meetings, I recall I had a talk with the president. Despite all the seriousness of the situation, he still continued to have a sense of humor. He reached over and said to me, "Hubert, if I knew it was going to be like this, I would have let you win." And I jokingly responded, "Well, Mr. President, you didn't know, but I knew it was going to be like this. That's why I let you win. That's why I let you win, period." It was just one of the ways that he had of release from tension. Paragraph. I've often wondered why the Kennedy administration never brought in those of us, never brought in to talk with those of us that had spent a considerable amount of time with Khrushchev. I attribute this to the lack of sensitivity in the State Department or in the Central Intelligence Agency. I suppose it could be explained by the fact that those of us that had visited the Soviet Union and had talked to Khrushchev had been fully debriefed by the CIA, and we had also reported to the Secretary of State and the high State Department and defense officials. I had spent 8 hours with Khrushchev in 1958. I had taken detailed and elaborate notes. Following that conference, I reported directly to President Eisenhower of my conversations with Khrushchev, and subsequently to Secretary of State Dulles, and then to a very high-level meeting of top national security people from State Defense and the National Security Agency. I suppose all of those all of my remarks had been taken down, and obviously this material was in the files of the State Department and the CIA. Nevertheless, when Kennedy was preparing to go to Paris and Vienna in 1961, I often wondered why it was that they didn't call in Mrs. Roosevelt and Adlai Stevenson and myself and possibly others who had met with Khrushchev and who had had some opportunity to take the measure of the man. I was even more in a quandary about this failure when I saw what happened in Vienna when Kennedy met Khrushchev. There's no doubt in my mind that Kennedy was taken by surprise by the nature of Khrushchev, the way he would come at you, and his tactics. All of this was predictable. What Khrushchev did in Vienna was what he had done in every meeting that he'd had with any prominent American. I've often said that he gave you the hit and run type of treatment. He'd come at you, and then he'd back off. He'd come hard, and then he'd soften up. He'd test you, and then he'd withdraw. He'd shock you, and then he'd try to placate. It was like my father-in-law used to try to relieve himself from chilblains. I remember Grandpa Buck would put his feet in a pan of hot water, and then after they'd get good and warm, he'd immediately dip them into a pan of cold water. Apparently the extremes of heat and cold would relieve whatever pain he had from his chilblains. Well, this is the way Khrushchev would treat you. He'd have you in a pan of hot water, and then he'd bring you on over into the cold water. It was as if you were being given, as you would say in football terms, a high and low block. He was always on the offensive, constantly changing his battle plan and his tactics. President Kennedy was not given the opportunity to talk directly with those of us that had visited with Khrushchev. Notes and reports are not nearly as revealing as the actual personal visit, which should have been given to Kennedy. The press reports of Kennedy's meeting with Khrushchev in Vienna indicated that Khrushchev had gone on the offensive at once and had threatened Kennedy and caught the president somewhat unawares, caught the president somewhat by surprise. I think all of this could have been avoided if the president had been more fully briefed. Now let me make some notes on my days as the majority whip of the United States Senate. Our majority leader was Mike Mansfield, and I was privileged to be majority whip by the election of the Democratic caucus. This was a high honor for me and a position that I held in great respect, period. It changed my political life. It was really the beginning of a whole new career for me. Now I was a member of the inner circle of the Senate. I was a part of the leadership, and I would occupy positions of considerable responsibility and power. Not only was I elected as the majority whip, but I soon became a member of the Senate Committee on Appropriations, a most important and powerful assignment. I was also made a member, I had been a member of the Steering Committee, which is the committee that makes the selection of members for all other committees of the Congress. Again, another important committee assignment. But as Majority Whip, I became a member of the Senate Policy Committee, of the Senate Democratic Policy Committee, a very major assignment in the structure of the Senate power structure. Likewise, I continued my membership on the Committee on Foreign Relations, my membership on the Committee on Government Operations, where I was a subcommittee chairman, and my membership on the Committee on Agriculture and Forestry. No one could have had better committee assignments. Likewise, I had considerable seniority by now. I was going into my 12th year as a United States Senator. And 12 years of service in the Senate does give you seniority and position. But the position of Majority Whip brings you into a unique set of relationships with all of the members of the Senate, and particularly with the majority members. My first task was to get adequate office space, and I was assigned a wonderful, a beautiful little office on the third floor of the Capitol building, right above the majority leader's office. I don't suppose I've ever had an office that I enjoyed more, even though the facilities were not elaborate or large, but there was something of quality and distinction about them. Out of my window, I could look out under the steps of the east front of the Capitol, and many, many nights I recall working in that office and looking out to see the Navy band or the Air Force band or the Army band playing a concert in front of the Capitol, with people sitting on the steps and enjoying the marvelous music. The location of the office made it possible for me to be very close to the Senate floor, so that I could be present at all times, at any time, and a moment's notice. I had watched Lyndon Johnson very carefully. I'd observed his work as leader and tried to measure the effectiveness of his techniques and tactics. Of course, all people are different in their ways of leading. In other words, leadership has a relationship to the character of the man, of the person who has the title. Each of us does it. Each of us leads in our own way. Senator Mansfield, while not a forceful leader, is an effective leader. He does it because of he is able to lead because of the respect with which he is held by his colleagues. He's a man of complete honor and integrity. He is a quiet man, but he has deep convictions. He never seeks to pressure anyone, nor does he try to bully or punish or even reward. He relies upon the individual senator to do his duty, to vote his convictions. I believe he fully understands when someone can't follow his lead. It may be because of circumstances back in the senator's home state, where the political conditions may not make it possible for that senator to follow the lead of the majority leader. Also, while Senator Mansfield, as majority leader, was very loyal to President Kennedy, he did represent the administration's policies on the floor of the Senate. Again, he was not demanding. He had hoped that he might be persuasive simply by his argument and not by any type of wheeling and dealing. Johnson, of course, as I've explained, was a powerful leader, and he used every known method of convincing and persuasion. He was a total political man. He attended to every detail of his job. Nothing escaped his observation or his judgment. I tried to blend in my role as Majority Whip some of the qualities of both. The first thing I sought to do was to become well acquainted with my colleagues, not only acquainted by name and by their state, but acquainted with their habits, with their family, with their background, and with their needs politicians representing a particular state. It is so important that a leader know all about those whom he is to lead. The majority whip is in essence the deputy leader, the assistant. Here again, he does not set the pattern, but once the pattern is set, he tries to effectuate it, to make it a reality. I believe that my teaming with Senator Mansfield was a good combination. Mansfield was a more of a passive individual, and while I was a much more aggressive person. I did not hesitate to go to my colleagues and seek and ask for their vote on an issue if I thought we needed it in order to carry the bill or the administration legislation. I was fully dedicated to carrying out the administration policies. I worked very closely with President Kennedy, and was in close contact with the then Vice President Lyndon Johnson. I do believe that President Kennedy did depend on me to be a leader in his behalf in the Senate, just as he did upon Senator Mansfield. But the two of us seemed to complement each other, and I found it easy to work with Senator Mansfield. He was never demanding of me, and he permitted me to operate the whip's office pretty much on my own standards. We did not have a great deal of staff, not nearly what was provided in later years, but the staff was adequate to keep abreast of the developments in the Senate. I worked out a good relationship with the minority whip of the Senate, Senator Thomas Kuchel, K-U-C-H-E-L, of California. Tom and I became close personal friends. It is important that leaders of both the majority and the minority have a good working relationship. Nothing succeeds in the Senate if you try to pull an end run or a sneak play. Everything has to be above the board, so that both majority and minority know what the rules are and what the game plan is. Or to put it in more directly, you don't cheat, you don't cut the corners, you work openly and in frankness with your colleagues as well as with your opposition. Tom Kuchel was easy to work with, and our relationship became a very personal and warm one. And to this very day, I cherish him as a dear and good friend. I recall President Johnson saying to me during the time that I was majority whip that the secret to success in any close battle in the Senate was to know the rules, number one, and number two, to know the players. I studied the rules of the Senate so that I was acquainted with them, because those rules in a critical close situation can be of vital importance. You can be outmaneuvered so quickly and in a thoroughly honest and honorable manner if you're not fully acquainted with the rules. But even more importantly, you must know the individual senators. You must have a sense of timing. You must know what you can expect from a senator. And there are times that a senator is not as willing to be cooperative as on another occasion. It may be something personal. It may be that he's had difficulties at home or in his home state, or that he's run into political problems. Therefore, as majority whip, I tried to keep a good running account on every senator that I thought we needed to depend upon. I believe this was helpful in garnering the votes that were needed in critical situations. The whip days, as I call them, were some of my most exciting days in the Senate. Not only because of the committee assignments, not only because I was part of the leadership that met every Wednesday morning with the president and the vice president and some members of the cabinet. Of course, those meetings were of critical importance, and they were in many ways exciting and at times dramatic. Just the opportunity to sit with the president and the vice president, along with the speaker and the majority leader of the House and the Senate, and the top administration officials to discuss the legislative program, or to be briefed on a critical international situation, or to hear the president give a report on one of his visits with another head of state. All of this was a very unique experience and a tremendous learning experience. It brought one into, you were a part of the living history of your time. You were involved up to the, almost, you were involved as few others. You knew more about what was going on than most others. It was just a rare privilege to be a part of the congressional leadership that met regularly, that met frequently with the president and with his top aides, that met with the top cabinet officers, particularly those cabinet officers in the field of national security. And then to the Kennedy-Johnson period, during which I served as majority whip, were exciting years in the domestic front. These were the years of the civil rights revolution. These were the years of the beginning of militancy in the American politics. These were the years when new programs were being fashioned to meet the problems of an urbanized America and to face up to the needs of education and health and other social services in our country. Just to be involved at the highest level in the fashioning of these programs and in their initiation was like being present almost at creation. Not only was I involved at the point where the programs were outlined by the president or his aides, but those same programs then had to be translated into legislative action over in the Congress. And it was there that those of us in a leadership role had new responsibilities and new and more demanding challenges than ever before. My work, it was in these leadership meetings with the president where the programs were developed and discussed that were to provide economic assistance to Appalachia, that were ultimately to evolve into what is known as the Economic Development Administration. It was here where the first discussions took place of the war on poverty and ultimately the development of the Office of Economic Opportunity and the so-called poverty programs. It was here that we discussed the controversial issue of federal aid to education and how it could be advanced and brought to a vote in the House and the Senate, brought to a successful vote in the House and the Senate. And it was, of course, in these meetings, along with others, that the outlines of the over the comprehensive civil rights bills, Civil Rights Act of 1964 was discussed in great detail. There were many arguments over the provisions, how far we should go, how far the president should go, and what would happen in Congress if certain steps were taken. I can remember specifically how President Kennedy and his brother, the Attorney General Robert Kennedy, were very dubious as to whether or not we could pass a fair employment practices provision in an overall civil rights bill. And it was decided not to send a civil rights bill with that section in it. It was decided not to send to the Congress a civil rights bill with a equal employment opportunity section in it. And then later on, of course, the House of Representatives added that provision. And subsequently, of course, it became law. Then there were new legislative initiatives that were to be taken, such as the Peace Corps and the Office of the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, the Disarmament Agency. These were three areas in which I had a specific interest. And President Kennedy saw to it that I had the opportunity to introduce this legislation and to sponsor it in the Congress. He could have, if he'd so desired, have asked others to do so, because when the President sends a proposal to the Congress, frequently it is the chairman of the committee that receives the legislation will introduce the administration's the administration's bill. In the instance of the Peace Corps and the Arms Control Agency, the President saw to it that I had the opportunity to present, to introduce the legislation under my name. It had been these proposals that he and I had argued over and debated about in the presidential primaries of 1960. And so it was the President himself who suggested that I author the Peace Corps and also the Arms Control Agency. I managed these bills through the Congress, through the Senate, and of course they ultimately became public law. I remember so well our discussion about the Arms Control Agency. It took place at the very time that there was a rise in tension in Europe, when the Russians were bearing down on Berlin once again, and when the President had felt the necessity of calling up reserves and strengthening our forces in Western Europe and in Berlin. The President asked me over to the White House for a luncheon one noon and talked with me about the legislative program before the Congress. And it was during that luncheon that I approached him on the subject of the Arms Control Agency. And we both noted that it was possibly not the most propitious time for presentation of a bill that would establish an agency for disarmament. After all, we were in a very real sense rearming. The President was strengthening our Defense Department, and there was a critical situation between ourselves and the Russians in Berlin. Nevertheless, this discussion as to over the Arms Control Agency not only took place over the luncheon table, but also in the swimming pool. I recall that when I arrived at the White House, the President said, "Let's go take a swim in the White House pool." We went on over and proceeded to go skinny dipping in the pool. I've never forgotten it, because President Kennedy kept the pool at about 90 degrees or more. He had back trouble, and the swimming in the warm water was very helpful, was very comforting and soothing to him. Following the swim, we sat out in the Rose Garden and had a luncheon, just the two of us, visiting about legislation and particularly the Arms Control Agency. I told the President that I'd like to introduce the legislation if it could get White House support. I made it clear to the President that without White House support, I didn't think the legislation would have a chance or a prayer, but that if he would put the power of his office behind it and could get the State Department and the Defense Department to line up in support, that I thought we could make a go of it and that we could pass it. He was familiar with what I had in mind, because again, this had been a subject of our debates out on the campaign trail. He told me to go ahead and to offer my bill, that I should expect that the State Department and the Defense Department would undoubtedly offer suggestions and modifications, but that basically he was in support of it and that he would give me a helping hand. It was with that signal that I proceeded to introduce the legislation. I processed it through the Committee on Foreign Relations and managed the bill on the floor of the Senate. It was a hotly contested legislative proposal, and there were several close votes. And one of the main arguments was over what we ought to call the agency, the new agency that was to be established, and also where it should be located in the executive branch of the government, and obviously what its powers should be. Ultimately, instead of calling it the Disarmament Agency, we call it the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, a compromise with those, if you please, who didn't want our government to have an agency that was dedicated to disarmament. We had to face the facts of politics, and the facts were that there just wasn't enough, there just wasn't a majority support for that kind of, for the disarmament agency title. Well, it didn't bother me a bit to call it arms control, because essentially that's what it was. We were obviously not going to disarm, but we needed to work, we needed to have a control program over the armament race, over the buildup of armaments, and to see the, and to see if we can't, couldn't work not towards a unilateral disarmament, but towards a disarmament, towards an arms control and disarmament program that would be balanced between ourselves and the Soviet Union. The other issue was, where should it be located? There were those of us that felt that it should be an entirely separate, independent agency reporting directly to the president. Again, well, after hours of debate, after many days of hearings and hours of debate, it was decided to locate it within the Department of State, but as an autonomous unit, reporting to the secretary and directly to the president, and also to the Congress. This was a unique administrative structure, because ordinarily, any agency with any bureau or agency within a department had its responsibility was to report only to the head of the department. But in this instance, the Arms Control Agency would be completely independent except for budget, for administrative purposes, that is budget control and the presentation of its budget. It would report to the Secretary of State, but it was not under the control of the Secretary of State, and it would report directly to the President, who in turn would be obviously would obviously have the ultimate authority and direction over the agency itself. So the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency became a fact of life. The critical question was whether it should have any research capacity of its own. In other words, should it be able to conduct studies as to the need of an armament of a particular weapon system, or what was going on in terms of weapons technology. The vote was very close, and as I recall, we won it only by one vote. But the authority was vested in the Arms Control Agency to do its own independent research. These were two of the most important pieces of legislation that I handled during my days as whip of the Senate. These were bills to which I had given a great deal of time and thought and attention. And then there was the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. It was obvious that the time had come for the United States to take a lead on controlling nuclear weapons testing. President Eisenhower had more or less a gentleman's agreement with the Soviet Union for a period of time, limiting nuclear tests, but the Soviets had violated that agreement in 1960 period. Apparently they violated it because they wanted to conduct a series of big tests, a series of tests to verify their new missiles. They were in the process of catching up. Actually, they were behind the United States in missile technology and deployment, and they were not about to remain in that position despite any agreement with President Eisenhower. It should be understood that the agreement with Eisenhower was not a written agreement. It was not a treaty, but it was sort of what we would call a gentleman's agreement. When Kennedy became president, he continued to show his interest in the subject of nuclear technology and a halt to nuclear testing. I had been in the forefront of this argument for years, having been chairman of a special subcommittee on arms control and disarmament. I had held hearings and made elaborate studies which had been presented to the Congress, and had been a very articulate spokesman of a halt to further testing of nuclear weapons. It seemed to me that the time was at hand to cut back rather than to proceed with more testing and more nuclear weaponry. The president delivered a masterful address at American University in June of 1961, proposing that the United States would be prepared to stop all nuclear tests and would do so on a unilateral basis pending the Soviet response. In other words, we were willing to try, willing to take a chance, and to wait to see what would happen, what kind of a response the Soviet Union would make. It was a courageous address, and it immediately provoked a torrent of editorial comment, much of it favorable. Then there were those of us in the Congress who felt that this was the kind of leadership that we should support. I joined with Senator Tom Dodd of Connecticut, who up until then had been a critic of any possibility of halting nuclear tests, in presenting a resolution calling upon the President to proceed to develop a treaty with the Soviet Union for the halting of nuclear testing in the atmosphere, on the ground, and underwater. It was what we call a limited test ban. I spoke many times with Senator Dodd about this. It was important to get a man of his political persuasion on such a resolution. Those of us that were the acknowledged liberals in the Senate and had spoken out so frequently about the dangers of the nuclear arms race did not have the votes, nor did we have the strength to carry a resolution on our own. We had to break into what you might call the hardliner group, and Tom Dodd was one of those. Nevertheless, my relationship with Senator Dodd was very good. I knew he wanted to take the lead. If I knew he wanted to become involved on this issue, but he did not want to go all the way for a comprehensive nuclear test ban treaty. He wanted a limited one, and I said I was prepared to work with him on that basis. So we joined together in proposing the nuclear test ban, the limited nuclear test ban treaty resolution, commending the President for his leadership and his initiative, calling upon the President to engage the Soviet Union in negotiations, hopefully to arrive at a treaty that was acceptable to limit nuclear tests and to put a limit on nuclear testing. The President quickly responded to this congressional initiative and proceeded forthwith to enter into negotiations with the Soviet Union, which culminated in the signing of a nuclear test ban treaty. I was privileged as one of those who was the sponsor of this proposal to attend the signing ceremonies in Moscow. It was indeed one of the great moments of my public life. There I was again in the halls of the Kremlin. There I was at the table at the signing ceremony. There, lifting my glass of champagne, toasting Mr. Khrushchev and other leaders of the Kremlin, as that spirit of goodwill was so evident for the moment in the signing ceremony. Other members of the Senate were present as well, Senators Fulbright and Sparkman and Saltonstall and Aiken, just to mention some. My first trip to the Soviet Union had been in 1958. But it was in the wintertime, and of course Moscow was cold and drab. This was in July of 19. This was in the summer, I believe, of 1962. Check that date. Moscow looked much better. It was colorful. The people were dressed better. The shops were had much more merchandise in them. It just was a better looking city and a better looking country. But I had some advantage on that trip. I'd been there before, and I was able on that visit to show some of my colleagues around the city a bit. It was one of those present, of course, was our ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson. I mentioned to Adlai that one of the ways to find out what the people were like was to go down to the railroad stations in Moscow. There was a series of stations leading out that were from whence trains went to different parts of the Soviet Union, one up to the north, another out to the Siberia, and one to the south. I went down to these stations and took Adlai along with me and an interpreter. We talked to the plain citizens of the Soviet. We spent hours there. He couldn't hardly believe it, that we could communicate quite so well. Later on in that same visit, we went into one of the great parks of Moscow. It was there that I encountered, that we visited with a number of the young people of the Soviet Union. I was followed there by NBC television, and they were taking pictures of my conversation with the Soviet citizens. And continuing now on visit to the Soviet Union for the test ban treaty signing. While the NBC TV was taking these pictures, some Soviet agent must have picked up one of the canisters of films that had been laid on the ground, put on the ground by the NBC cameraman. Anyway, it disappeared. However, the balance of the film in the camera was retained, and subsequently these films were played back in the United States. The interesting part of this is that the conversation with Soviets went quite well. Obviously, there were some hardcore members of the Communist Party in the group that gathered around me as we discussed things in the park. But I remember one man in particular who had the courage to say that in the Soviet Union, the government didn't pay any attention to the people. He said, "All this talk about Soviet democracy is a mockery." I wondered what happened to this man, because he was so outspoken. There was yet another who was a veteran of World War II, and he spoke with such affection and kindness of the Americans, saying that the Americans were our comrades in arms, and that he hoped that he'd have the opportunity to visit the United States so that he might be able to say hello to some of the American soldiers that had fought in the Great War. But there was one or two hardcore communists who wanted to engage in ideological struggle and battle. They were particularly critical of the race relations of the United States, and I pointed out to them that we were fully aware of the injustices to the blacks, the American Negro. But I said we were willing to talk about it. It was in our press. And not only that the blacks were demonstrating and showing their discontent, that they were giving, that they were more and more, that more and more of them were getting the right to vote and to participate politically. But I made it clear that the progress had not been adequate for me, that I was one of those that was forcing the issue. And I said, "What are you doing about civil liberties in the Soviet Union?" We had a real knockdown good argument, and it was at this point where a Soviet citizen stood up and said, "Yes, in the Soviet Union, you could never talk like you are, Senator Humphrey. Here, you would be hauled off to jail. But in your country, at least you have the right to protest." It was a very revealing discussion, and it showed that amongst the young people, and these were relatively young people, there was this spirit of dissent, which apparently came out as I visited with them over a substantial period of time. I recall that one of the young men looked at my suit. He just kept his eyes fixed upon it. Frankly, it wasn't very much of a suit. That is, it wasn't too costly. It was a Botany 500, which at that time sold for about $60. And I pointed, and this young man looked at my suit and asked me about it. I said, "Well, why don't you try on the coat?" He did so, and I can remember him running his hands down the sleeve of the coat. He seemed to be just caressing it. It seemed so beautiful, or so good to him. And he asked me how much it cost, and I told him. At first he didn't believe it, but I said it is a fact, and I tried to explain to him that while it wasn't a high price suit, it was what the average American would purchase, a middle-income American. And I pointed out that this would be about equivalent to one-half week's salary. And that was that a worker in America would be getting over $100 a week at that time. And that this suit would maybe be the equivalent to about 2 to 2.5 days of work, of income for work. And then I realized that this same suit would undoubtedly cost a Russian a month's work. So we discussed things on the basis of comparative economics. By and large, the discussion was a friendly one and very candid. When I left, I wondered what would happen to those that had spoken up so freely. The only way that you get to know people is to search them out, and that's why on my visits abroad, I had never contented myself with staying with simply the officials and the charted course of my journey. I've always believed that you had to break ranks, get out on the streets, see what people were like, engage them in conversation. And I've done this repeatedly in the Soviet Union, going down into the subways, talking with people there, with anybody that would be willing to stop long enough just to engage in conversation, and going to the railroad stations, out on the streets and into the parks. With a good interpreter, you can do this and do it quite easily. And surprisingly, you will find that most people in most countries have pretty much the same hopes and desires. Most of them are, of course, passionately nationalist, in other words, devoted to their country. But all of them have little gripes and matters which they want to get off their chest. And if you just spend enough time with them, you'll find that they'll talk. The desire for liberty and for freedom is a powerful one. It's almost as strong as the instinct of survival. I sometimes wonder how a police state can exercise such unbelievable control as it does. It does, but of course it does so at a terrible human cost. Paragraph. The Kennedy, during my days as whip, there were other matters that were coming to the forefront, the space program, for example, and I took a great interest in it. Of course, Vice President Johnson had been the leader in the Senate as the majority leader for our space efforts. He had designed the legislation for the National Aeronautics and Space Agency. He had represented President Eisenhower at the United Nations when President Johnson laid out before the UN some of the dimensions of the American space program. With President Kennedy coming into the White House and my being majority whip, with President Kennedy coming into the White House, the Johnson effort in space was given extra impetus, because the president himself was deeply involved and much in support of it. But the country had to get geared up to the space effort, and a series of laboratories were to be established across the nation. Put America in the forefront of the space effort. I recall wanting one of these laboratories in Minnesota. I knew that it would mean additional industry and new developments in our state if this could happen, and I was negotiating with the president to make sure that this did happen. My conversations took place with Larry O'Brien and Kenny O'Donnell, with Meyer Feldman and Fred Dutton and others in the White House, and I also had spoken to the president himself. Of course, many of the laboratories were to be established in the Boston area, where great advances had already been made in space technology and science. But I was assured by the president that one of those labs would come to Minnesota. And this development did not take place, however, because after Kennedy's death, President Johnson reassessed the whole program, and the installations were divided pretty much between Texas, Oklahoma, and Massachusetts, with Minnesota at best getting only a substantial grant for our university in the establishment of a Department of Aeronautics and Space. But at least we got this much out of it. I mention this simply because, as Majority Whip, you are, and any as a leader in the Congress, and in this instance, the position of Majority Whip, you can be present when these decisions are being made. You are there when the plans are in their early stages, and you can get your oar in. In other words, you can make your request, and I didn't hesitate to do so, because I made up my mind that as the Majority Whip of the Senate, carrying a good deal of the administration load for legislative policy, at least backing the president in his legislative endeavors and efforts, that I had a right to weigh in for things for Minnesota, and I did so on every opportunity, including a laboratory established under the sponsorship of the Bureau of Mines, housing programs for our state, space funds for our university, and every other project that could reach into, that could have any beneficial effort and beneficial impact on Minnesota. Prior to President Kennedy's, just a few months before President Kennedy went to that, on that tragic journey to Dallas, the president took a trip around the United States. He asked me to go with him. We first flew up to New York, where he was to make a speech, and then subsequently we came to Duluth, Minnesota, where we were met by the governor and by representatives from Wisconsin and Minnesota. I had hoped to travel with the president and his party out to Colorado, where he was to get a rest at Jackson, at that beautiful resort area known as Jackson Hole. However, in Minnesota, I got a call from Mike Mansfield asking me to return at once to Washington, and that Mansfield himself was going on the president's trip to Montana. This was understandable, but I know that I missed a very happy journey, because traveling with the president and his entourage was a delight, particularly if you were invited into the inner circle. And on this particular journey, I was close in. There was Kenny O'Donnell and Larry O'Brien, and there were other key members of the Kennedy staff. And the president was in good spirits all the way, filled with fun and having a great time. He invited me to go on to Jackson Hole, saying that it was going to be a great occasion, and there might be even a night of party and celebration. Well, as was my luck, I went back to my post of duty, but I heard that was one of the great stops of the journey. Woe is me. Of course, my greatest test as Majority Whip was when I was floor manager for the Civil Rights Act of 1964. This I have dictated on, and there's no need adding further to it, but it was the real test. Now a few reflections on staff. When I first came to Washington, I had a very small staff. My knowledge of the city was surely limited. As the mayor of Minneapolis, I thought I had done a good job, but the experiences there were no way truly relevant to what was to descend upon me here in the nation's capital. We geared up, however, for our work as best we could. And one of the young men that came to work for me that was of great help was Bill Sims, who had been my assistant while I was mayor of Minneapolis. He was a devoted person, and he was a good office manager, and he more than anyone else knew people back home in Minnesota. I mention this one quality because it's very important for a new senator to keep close ties to his people back home. When you get to Washington, you can get so involved in what's going on in this exciting and challenging city that you might very well lose track of your home base. But Bill Sims never let that happen. Every piece of mail was answered. He was very good he was attentive to the requests of our constituents. He worked tirelessly to make sure that the needs of, that the uh, the needs of our state were fully represented in all of the councils of government. Bill never tried to be a legislative assistant. He was in truth and in fact an administrative assistant. He administered an office. He saw that it ran well, and he took great pride in having a reputation for getting things done and for seeing to it that the Humphrey office was known for answering its mail, taking care of the constituents' needs, and responding to every communication and request. This is an invaluable asset in a man, particularly in a senator's office. So many constituent requests flow in that someone simply has to be on top of it. One of the weaknesses that often happens in a senator's office is that his associates decide that they are senators, or that they want to be the policymakers, or that they want to be the legislators. Bill Sims never let that happen to him. In other words, he understood what his position was. It was to be an assistant to the senator and not to be an alter ego. He was to take care of home base as best he could, and I, as the senator, was to be the legislator. However, I did have someone with me, another partner with me, that had been helpful to me in the campaign of 1948 and had been particularly helpful in my contacts with the labor movement. He was a very close friend of the Textile Workers Union. Textile Workers Union in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and also knew the international president of the Textile Workers Union, Emil Reavy. This was a valuable contact for me because the textile workers in Minnesota, along with the International Lady Garment Workers, were unions that had membership out around the state and not merely in the Twin Cities. They and the Railroad Brotherhoods were the base of labor support throughout the state, and provided a base of political support for me in many of the smaller towns. This man that I speak of was Max Campbellman. He had been a student at the University of Minnesota. He had been a teacher. He later on became a teacher at Bennington College up in Bennington, Vermont. He left his position as a professor at Bennington College and came to help me in Washington, D.C. He was an extraordinarily gifted man, understanding legislation and having a particular interest in and knowledge of labor law. He not only had an education in the field of political science, but also was a lawyer, a very helpful combination for anyone that was to serve in a senator's office. It was Max Campbellman who helped me with my work on the Labor and Public Welfare Committee. It was he who helped design legislation in the field of healthcare education and labor management policy. Max broadened his contacts with the labor movement and became my spokesman and contact with many of the international representatives, with many of the international officers of organized labor. He also was particularly active and helpful with me in my work with the Americans for Democratic Action. Max was what I would call a pragmatic liberal. His political background was that of a socialist, and indeed a pacifist. The realities of public life brought him around to be a card-carrying Democrat, and subsequently. An active supporter of a strong defense system for our country. During the war years, he was a conscientious objector and had gone through all of the rigors and tests and ordeals that the military put the military required of the of a conscientious objector, including going on a starvation diet to test the ability of the human body to withstand suffering and starvation. Max was a brilliant man, as truly a scholar, but with a flair for politics. He enjoyed the political meetings and political discussions. He brought to my attention, he helped expand my intellectual horizons. He constantly brought to my attention, he constantly brought in me into contact with the people, with intellectuals, and with intellectuals, particularly in the field of political science and economics. He was an active member of the American Political Science Association, and encouraged me to take an active role in that association. Subsequently, I was elected as vice president of the American Political Science Association, and more so through Max Kampelman's efforts than my own. A man in public life needs people with him who have a sense of outreach, someone who can bring others to him, to stretch his mind, to challenge his ideas, and indeed to implant new ideas. Period. This was the role that Max filled better than anyone else. He would never permit me to get into a rut, either in terms of legislative program or ideas. He would constantly push push forward policies policies and positions that he thought merited my attention. He would fortify those positions by excellent documentation. He was a superb writer, but most of all, he seemed to know where to go for new thought, and particularly creative thought. I am always being indebted to him for bringing me into an ever wider range of contact with people of different disciplines. While it is true that from a political point of view, his work on my behalf with the labor movement was of the greatest significance, from the point of view of my own education and the expansion of my own thought and intellectual horizons, it was the people that he brought to me that represented his greatest contribution. And to this very day, he continues to do just that. Max was not only my legislative assistant, but he became a dear and close friend. He was loyal and trustworthy, but he never let his personal loyalty to me, stand in the way of presenting a good argument if he thought I was wrong. I've always believed that it was important for a person in public life to surround himself with different types of personalities and people of at least somewhat different political persuasion. I have never wanted on my staff just people that were in agreement with me. I have instructed my staff people to challenge me with their ideas, that I would ultimately make the decision. But I didn't want to have to be out in front of them. I wanted them to be pushing me, in a sense, serving me not only with their daily work of answering mail and taking care of constituents, but of constructive thought, of challenging ideas, and never to hesitate to let me know if they thought I was wrong, or if they thought there was some other way that we ought to approach a problem. Max was a supreme diplomat in all of this. He was never abrasive. He could come around, he could tell you you were wrong in such a way that you almost felt it was a compliment. But he also had a way of bringing to you an alternative proposal, even as he demonstrated that you might be in error in your original judgment. These are unique qualities, and these were the qualities that have made Max Kampelman an excellent lawyer and a person that is highly regarded in his profession and amongst his intellectual equals. Paragraph. During this, in the 1950s, I placed a great deal of emphasis on agricultural policy. President Eisenhower brought into his cabinet a man by the name of Ezra Taft Benson as Secretary of Agriculture. He was the complete antithesis in ideas and policy of everything that I believed in. While undoubtedly an honorable man, he was, to put it mildly, very conservative, and I felt had little comprehension of the problems that affected American, the family farmer. Herbert Waters was a newspaper man. He came from California. He had worked closely in that he knew politics at the California level, having been active in campaigns in that state. And he also came from an agricultural area in California, so that he had some comprehension of basic agricultural policy. But most of all, he was a person of considerable intellectual ability, and was quick to learn about the complexities of a national agricultural program. Herb Waters was my specialist in agriculture, and this meant that he had a truly full-time task. Never have I seen anybody that worked harder or longer hours. I've never known anyone that had a better comprehension of agricultural economics and the politics of American agriculture. During those Eisenhower and Benson years, it was Herb Waters who supplied me with a constant flow of position papers and policy statements and arguments relating to what we ought to do as agricultural legislation and economics. In fact, Herb Waters in 1956 was an advisor to the Democratic candidate Adlai Stevenson on agricultural policy. He worked to help develop the plank in the Democratic platform concerning the Democratic Party's position on agriculture. I think it can be said that he, more than anyone else, wrote the agricultural plank. And later on, when Kennedy was elected, I recommended Herb Waters for a position in the field of international agriculture in the aid administration, and Herb did serve with considerable ability and effectiveness as a part of the foreign assistance program, helping to develop agricultural and food and nutrition policy. Not only food and nutrition policy for our government in its foreign aid efforts. I want you to get more stuff from Herb on his role with me. I've just given you a little bit here. Ask Herb to give you a few paragraphs about his role, and then we can rephrase it. If ever there was a war of political attrition, it was our struggle during the 1950s with Ezra Taft Benson. And Herb Waters was like Ulysses S. Grant, pounding away day after day on Benson and his policies. Herb provided me with reams of information. I recall that on one occasion he prepared and made available to me a documentation of the a critique of the Eisenhower-Benson agricultural policy that ran over 200 printed pages. I made this available to our colleagues in the Senate. It was the most comprehensive analysis of what we believe to be the limitations and fallacies of the Republican Benson agricultural policy that was presented during those years. Every debate on the floor of the Senate on agriculture, Herb would be there, not only supplying me with information, but also with other senators. He was looked upon with great respect by our colleagues. He knew what he was talking about, and he could back up his claims with he could back up his arguments with facts. In 1960, Herb served as my campaign manager out in Minnesota. He would drive himself literally to exhaustion. I never knew a man that could get fewer hours of sleep and still work on. Weakness. And Herb's one weakness was that he would try to do too much himself. He simply couldn't delegate. He would have letters and gathering up on his desk that he never could get around to answer. This was a very minor shortcoming, but being a rather detailed man myself, I would sometimes become irritated with this, with Herb. And then if I were to scold him, it simply would mean that he would work longer hours driving himself until he was literally exhausted. Well, in the campaign of 1960, of course, he was very active with me in the Democrat in the primaries. But I had to depend upon him a great deal back in the office during those days. Herb was working double shift, so to speak, both as helping me politically and at the same time trying to take care of as much of the office work as possible. He came out to Minnesota with me. No man that I've ever had work for me was better on substantive issues in politics than Herb. He loved politics and he liked political organization, but he also knew his subject matter. And in this instance, his subject matter was agriculture. He was a constant advisor not only to me in this matter, but to a number of other Democratic senators. And later on, when President Kennedy was running for office, Herb Waters helped write a number of the speeches that Kennedy gave on subjects of agriculture. Likewise, in 1956, he wrote for Adlai Stevenson. We had some trouble with Adlai. He never quite wanted to go as far as we thought he ought to. But by cajoling and persuasion and just getting the documents in front of Adlai, we finally were able to get him to come around. Agricultural policy was a basic issue in those years, because the Republican administration with Benson at the head of the Department of Agriculture was considered a disaster to the farmers. And this was one place where we could make points, and no one knew how to write a speech better than Herb when it came to the subject of agriculture. Strangely enough, he also had the respect and appreciation of the people in agribusiness. He understood the food processing business. He realized that it was tied in directly to the agricultural production. So here he was, a friend of the Farmers Union on the one hand, working very closely with their legislative representatives, and also with a number of the large food processing companies and the grain trading companies. Herb understood foreign trade. He understood the importance of exports. He likewise understood the development of a national food policy, which included a system of government supports for agriculture, advanced research with heavy contributions and investments in research, along with a grain storage program that would protect the farmer from price-depressing surpluses. I've never known anybody that was quite as competent in this area. Later on, when Kennedy became president, Herb was appointed as a member of the administration working in the Foreign Assistance Administration. It was here that he gave a great deal of his time and attention to the overall to economic development overseas, and with particular emphasis upon food and nutrition. In the campaign of 1960, after the Democratic primaries in which I had participated with, contested with Jack Kennedy, I had to go back home to Minnesota and run for re-election. Herb was my campaign manager. It looked to me like it would be a rather easy, it looked to me like it would be a contest that I could readily win. My opponent was the then mayor of Minneapolis, P. Kenneth Peterson, who, by the way, had been an old college friend of mine. He and I had been on the University of Minnesota debate team. All the early polls showed me far in advance and far ahead. Therefore, from time to time, I would swing out of Minnesota and go to New York and other places on behalf of President Kennedy. My credentials with the black community were particularly good, and I made a series of meetings in the large metropolitan areas amongst blacks. So, speaking for our Democratic candidate, John Kennedy. Also, I spoke a good deal around the Midwest for him. Apparently, these forays out of the state started to take their toll. At least the Minnesota poll, which had been the most accurate public opinion survey we have in our part of the country, showed just about 2 weeks before the election that P. Kenneth Peterson, the Republican candidate, was fast closing the gap between himself and myself. Well, this surely, this needless to say, caused me great concern. I called in my staff and I read them the Riot Act. I told them that they were failing in their duties and their campaign organizational efforts. And I reminded Herb and others that it was time that we quit this running around the country, because they had been urging me to do some of it. I raised so much hell that I found out later on that Herb Waters sent wires to a number of prominent Democrats, and indeed to the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, demanding huge sums of money in order to save me in the last couple of weeks. Senator Field will never forget it. He has reminded me again and again of receiving a telegram signed by Herbert Waters that read as follows: Humphrey's campaign in trouble. If Humphrey loses, it's your fault. Send $15,000 at once. Well, Herb apparently was persuasive with at least a few, because we got a little help from the Senatorial Campaign Committee. We received more help from our good friends in the International Lady Garment Workers Union, the steel workers, and a few others. But Herb was the kind of a man that when the chips were down, he went the whole distance for you. There was no, there never was any lack of loyalty on his part. During those years of the, particularly of the 50s and the early 1960s, one of my closest advisors in the field of agriculture was the head of the Farmers Union Grain Terminal Association, William Thatcher. I've never known anybody quite like him. He was truly a unique American. In his youth, he was an accountant. He was a stormy, petulant character, having strong political views. He'd started out in North Dakota. He was active in the nonpartisan league. He knew all of the so-called left of center politicians, and yet in every inch of his makeup, he was a businessman's type. But he was a free thinker, and a person who had an uncanny political sense, who had considerable political sensitivity and political savvy. He was close to Franklin Roosevelt during the days of the 1930s. He helped get underway the Bank for Cooperatives. He encouraged Roosevelt and his programs for agriculture. He was constantly down at Washington, banging on the door of the White House, demanding things being done for the Midwest, including the ever-normal granary and the farm support price support program. He was a close personal friend of Henry Wallace, And he worked hand in hand with Wallace all during those years when Wallace was Secretary of Agriculture and during the war years when Wallace was the chairman of the Board of Economic Warfare. Well, Bill Thatcher was able to develop and organize one of the largest farm cooperatives in America. It was a resounding success. It handled literally hundreds of millions of bushels of wheat, reaching out across the states of Kansas, of North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, Minnesota, and in other parts of the country. It was a well-run business. Unlike many farm cooperatives, it had the kind of management that made it that was bound to make it a success. Bill Thatcher believed in going first class. He supported me from the very beginning, even though at many times he was critical of some of my views. He was a political maverick, or I guess somebody might call just a political independent, even though most of the candidates that he supported were either Democrats or, in our state, Democratic farmer laborites. Nevertheless, he saw fit to support a man like Milton Young, Senator Milton Young of North Dakota, Carl Mundt of South Dakota. Why? Because they were interested in rural America, because they voted right on agricultural legislation, because they were friends of the farm cooperative movement, even though they were relatively conservative Republicans. He was a close friend of Robert Taft's, in fact supported Taft in the 1952 primaries when Taft ran against Eisenhower. Why? Well, once again, because Taft was more friendly towards the cooperatives. Bill Thatcher believed that the cooperatives were the salvation of the farmers. He believed that farmers must have strength, that they must have political power, and he knew that one of the ways to have it was to organize, and to organize powerful farm cooperatives where farmers had a deep loyalty to the cooperative because it was beneficial to them. Bill Thatcher conducted an immense educational program. He had their own, the Farmers Union Grain Terminal and newspaper that went out weekly to all of his members. And every year there'd be a huge conference lasting about 3 days. And the conference was something to behold, anywhere from 10 to 15,000 people attending with a magnificent program of entertainment and speakers. He didn't hesitate to ask a president or a vice president, and surely he had all of the senators and congressmen from the entire Midwest area. Bill believed in having the farm, and Bill knew that farmers, like other people, wanted recognition, and he didn't believe in acting like he was on the poverty program. He drove a big car. He dressed like a banker. The Farmers Union GTA had a seat on the Minneapolis Grain Exchange. He hobnobbed with the top people in the community. He was a member of the board of directors of the American National Bank in St. Paul. In other words, he was a part of the establishment, even though he was as much a liberal and much a progressive and maverick as you could possibly find. His political associates were as varied as a Minnesota smorgasbord. There was Bill Langer, Milt Young of North Dakota. There was Carl Mundt of South Dakota. Then there was Hubert Humphrey and Gene McCarthy of Minnesota. And then, of course, Minnesota congressmen, including some of the Republicans as well as the Democrats. And then over in Wisconsin, there would be Gaylord Nelson. And later on, George McGovern out in South Dakota. He considered each of these his boys. He took time out to be with them. He would call them on the telephone, invite them over to his office. I remember one particular visit when I complimented him on the beautiful boardroom that the GTA had. And he said, "Why not?" He said, "When these farm directors come in here, they're all members of the board of directors. I want them to feel like they are something. So they have the best, they have the finest boardroom in the Twin Cities. They have beautiful, soft, big chairs. And when they're here, they know they're board members of a huge enterprise. And that's the way it ought to be. In other words, Bill didn't believe in walking around in ashes and sackcloth. He was constantly talking politics, though. And he would never hesitate to give you his point of view. He was an unusual person with the widest range of mental intellectual interest. Everything from politics to business to science and technology to medicine. And above all, he was devoted to chiropractic, to the chiropractic profession. He felt that he kept a chiropractor on at the GTA headquarters at all times. And two of his sons took up chiropractic to become professionals in that field of the healing arts. Thatcher was not the kind of a man that sought out people. He was the sort of a person whom other people sought to see. I remember so well that when John Kennedy came to Minnesota, it was Kennedy who stopped over to see Thatcher, not Thatcher to see Kennedy. And the same thing, of course, was true when Bob Taft was in the state, or when Lyndon Johnson came by as President of the United States and as Vice President. And likewise, it was the very same thing with Harry Truman and Henry Wallace and anyone else that was a leading political figure. Bill sat on his throne, so to speak, over there at the Farmers Union GTA at Snelling and Larpenter in St. Paul, and had the big men and women of American politics and economics.